This is the Penalty Office Music Business 101 podcast series. I'm Neil Levine.
And I'm Warren Schatz.
We'll be having conversations about everything from old school music business to the current state of the business. Everything from hip hop to pop. We'll have lots of guests and go pretty deep.
So we're really happy to have Mitch Dudley on our Penalty Office podcast today. I've known Mitch Dudley for many years from the distribution side. I even knew him when he was still rapping as Mickey. So Mitch, why don't you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you've been with Sony for many years now.
I have.
Moved over from Red Distribution, and now you're at The Orchard. So why don't you kind of tell our listeners and us a little bit about you?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you and Big Dub. That's what I call Warren Big Dub for having me on the podcast. Something real interesting before we even get into all of that. I'm talking to a friend of mine yesterday. You probably know him, Mike Canner. He used to be head of sales at Roadrunner. Me and him worked together way back in the day. And he goes, hey, do you listen to podcasts? And I'm like, I listen to a few. He's like, there's this really good podcast. Remember Neil Levine? And I'm like, dude, I'm going to be on that podcast tomorrow. So here we are.
Wow. It's small world.
It's so weird. He was like, oh, man, it's such a great podcast. And I'm like, I'm on it tomorrow, bruh.
Yeah, that's great. Great story. That's great.
Just one of the quick ones.
So I know, Mitch, though, you've been in the distribution business for many years, right?
I mean,
Pearl in Brooklyn to moving over to Red. So why don't you kind of school us and school the audience on what a distributor does and how it's changed over the years since you've been doing this for many years?
Me and you met like way back in the days when you had Around the Globe Music. You know, I got to blow that up because Around the
Globe, right,
like on the pulse of everything that was happening in the streets, and you guys were helping to break those records. So that's kind of my era back in those Around the Globe days when I was at Pearl Music. And back then, distribution was a whole different game because there were physical products. There were CDs and vinyl records and... Remember the cassette single and the maxi cassette? Like, it was physical product. You had to actually go to a store to buy it. Stores actually had to buy it from a wholesaler or a distributor, and that's where I worked. You know, I was pretty much an order taker and a warehouse worker. You called for the records, I went and picked them and shipped them to you. And that's what distribution was back then. It was all about physical product. The artists had to get out into the streets and shake hands and kiss babies. It was more interactive. It was, you know, you had things to touch and feel. Nowadays, fast forward, you know, 20, 25 years, it's, you don't even have to touch anything but a button on your computer. And you can listen to everything you ever wanted or everything that's coming. Technology has definitely changed. It's definitely advanced from, you know, something primitive like, you know, a physical piece of product that you had to actually go out and buy and anticipate. And there were lines outside the door every Friday waiting for that new record, whatever it was. And now you just sit at home and wait for 1201 for the store to turn at Spotify or Tidal or wherever you listen to your music, and you hit a button. But the mechanisms behind the scene is still the same. You know, you still have to deliver a product. There's still people who need to move the parts and pieces around to get it to the consumer. Yeah, it used to be a physical piece of product. Now it's just press and listen.
What is the difference in the drivers between then and now?
I mean, to me, the drivers remain the same. To me, when it comes to marketing, it's always the same. You always have to put yourself in front of the consumer that you're trying to appeal to. Whether, you know, you're a skateboarder or you're a beer drinker, there's always an audience that you can promote to that likes what you're doing or like the music that you're doing or like what you're listening to. So the drivers and the marketing, to me, it never changed. Marketing is always just finding where you fit and accelerating that whole thing to make a bunch of people feel what you do. Maybe the way you market things have changed, but the narrative of it all is kind of the same. Just like I was saying earlier, when there was a physical piece of product, the artists used to do what we called in stores, where they would go out and do meet and greets, and they would physically sit in the store for a couple of hours, sign a few hundred autographs just to juice the numbers. Now there's a lot of manipulation in the background with bots and all of the, and all of these type of technical things that kind of manipulates the numbers. But it's still the same thing. People are just still trying to manipulate the numbers. So it's all the same. It's just the way you're doing it now.
So what are the ways that you're doing it now?
I mean, people are buying into these programs. I mean, everybody knows what botting is, and botting, it juices the numbers. It makes it look like people are listening to things that they're not actually listening to. You can buy into a program, they'll have a robot put you on a playlist and give you 100 plays. But nowadays, there's mechanisms in place that goes, hold on, wait a minute. How did this person get 100 plays, but he only has 5 listeners? So that means each one of those listeners had to listen to it 20 times each, and no one else listened to it. So it's kind of, I mean, for everything that they come up with to manipulate the system, there's always going to be something that comes back to combat it. And that's been the thing over the years. It's like you figure out how to juice the numbers to increase your popularity, and then there's always someone to figure out how to take that out of the mix. But there's always going to be manipulation and then something to come.
What are the more organic ways that people can really do it who don't have a lot of money? For a lot of our audience are young rappers who are just getting started. What's, from your perspective, what's the easiest way to get your music in front of people? What were the marketing to TikTok, or is it at running social media programs?
There is no easy way. If there was an easy way, everybody would be doing it. All of those things that you said, TikTok, it's a little bit of all of that. Nowadays, and even back then, it took 7 impressions to make a consumer, and even today, it takes 7 impressions to make a consumer move. And when I say impressions, it means they got to hear about it from their friend, they got to read it somewhere on a website, it has to pop up in their feed on Facebook, they see a thumbnail of the video, and then 3 other things to make people go, you know what, maybe I'm gonna click on this shit now.
Yeah, that's really just to notice it, correct?
Right.
That's really just to kind of get people to notice that, it takes 7
impressions. Things, 7 impressions. So
it's amazing.
To all the young guys out there, just like keep in mind that, yeah, a playlist helps you. But if someone goes on and do a Google search and nothing else pops up, the consumer doesn't really know who you are as a person. They just know a song. And that's why there are so many big songs and not big artists.
Back when I was in the distribution game, it was really hard to get a distribution deal. What a distributor wanted, they wanted to make sure you had a catalog, that you had enough finances to be able to properly market and promote your music, et cetera. So they're looking for a certain dollar amount per year in revenue, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Since the game has really changed and there's all these do-it-yourself kind of distributors, be it the TuneCore, Media Famous, which my man Domingo has, DistroKid, the list goes on. Then you have larger distribution companies like The Orchard, like ADA, like InGrooves, people that are doing it. So what type of services do you offer your clients to sign them and take a percentage of sales? Because a lot of these other do-it-yourself services, they just charge a fee and they don't take a percentage of sales. So what are you guys doing? What are the other distributors, the larger ones, doing to really get those labels in, service them properly, and give them what they believe that the percentage deserves? So kind of,
I mean, a lot of
fill us in out, Strange.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of distributors are offering what they call label services. But you got to realize, even with the label services game, there's a lot of bandwidth that comes with that. You know what I mean? The label services department cannot work every record that comes through the building. You just can't. As a independent label or an independent artist, you kind of got to get it going before other people take notice, because nobody wants to start from the ground. Everybody wants to jump on something that's already going, throw some fuel on it to keep it going. When it's at its infancy stage, it's just way too early to dedicate that much time. But if you get it going, that's when the rest of the building wakes up, per se. If you get something
going, what does that mean? What does that mean when the rest of the building wakes up?
That means you get those label services. They go, holy shit, something's happening over here. Now they start to pay attention. It's just because you can't work every record that comes through the building. You know, there's marketing services, there's creation of assets and tools, and then you have social media. Like, there's a team of people that you have access to, but it doesn't really kick in until you really got something going on, because there's just not enough bandwidth to take on as many projects that a distributor has to deal with. And that's why a lot of these cats come in kind of hot already. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of them come in hot. A lot of them don't need distribution, but they want a team to help them facilitate some of the things that they need to be done. Because, you know, homeboys, you know, from the block, he's here and he's there. He might do it, he might not do it. But if you have a team in place, you know you're getting that. And you don't get that with the TuneCores and the DistroKids. You know, you put a record up, it gets out, cool. Now, if you're fine with that, cool. But if you want somebody to guide you in your career and tell you what you should be doing and what you should not be doing, when you should do it and when you shouldn't be doing it, then that's where a distribution team with label services and a whole team comes in, because they'll help you facilitate some of the things that you might not even be thinking about as an independent artist.
Great. So how does radio play into this whole thing? Like, when we were coming up, it was all about getting your music on radio, because that was how people heard the new music, right? That's what broke records. You know, especially the major labels spent a good amount of their marketing promotion budget on radio promotion and staffing, you know, having a regional radio team across the country visiting radio. So how has that changed over the years as kind of the rollout of a new project?
I think it depends on the genre. I think with a genre like hip hop, radio doesn't really matter, because there's a bunch of little pockets of things going on. They're all appealing to their own audience and they're all making a lot of money doing it. And if it gets big enough to where it warrants radio, then they'll invest in it. On the R&B and the gospel side, on the other hand, radio is still a necessary and a viable, you know, piece of that puzzle, because that audience has yet to fully transition to streaming. Like, some of them missed the whole download phase, you know what I mean? So when they hear something on the radio, they want to physically go buy it. And that's why R&B and gospel artists, you'll still find a CD in Walmart or Target, you know what I mean? Because that's what that customer is still used to. That customer is not on the internet. They're listening to the radio. They're in the car. They're at home cleaning on a Sunday, listening to, you know, whoever's on the gospel channel on Sunday. And then they go, oh, I'm going to Amazon and I'm going to buy that CD. They have yet to transition to the whole digital phase of things. So the consumption of it is different. Do I still think radio is a piece of the pie overall? Yes. But if you listen to, you know, the hip hop side of things, they're like, fuck radio. Playlisting's the new radio. But now you got to get on the playlist, and then you got to keep it on the playlist. So in essence, playlisting is a little like radio, but they just don't mimic each other these days.
So what's your experience with getting on playlists? Do you have methodologies there to get on playlists?
There is no method to the madness. Everyone pitches the same curators and editors, and I don't even see how they do it, because they must be getting thousands and thousands of pitches every week, depending on what genres you deal with. So to me, I've even had a label tell me that the algorithms don't work. Fuck that. I'll just stay in the streets and do what I do. And then if the shit warrants to get on something, it'll eventually get there. But it's tough, man. It's tough. You got to have relationships, and sometimes that doesn't even help. You got to have information that warrants you getting onto a playlist. You got to have competitive information. Like, you really, it's like back in the day when you were trying to get on the fucking end cap, you know, at Virgin Record Stores. You know what I'm saying? You had to buy into it. Or you had to know somebody there who would just place your shit at the front door, so when people walked in, it was there. And that's the way it is now at the digital platforms. It's like, it's hard to get that placement at the front of the door when you walk in. You know what I mean?
Except the difference now is you can't pay for that placement the same way as you could pay for an end cap or some type of listening station or some type of marketing at the retail accounts. It seems like with, you know, Spotify and Apple, yeah, you can supply the information. But as far as I know, there's no one to pay. It's like they got to perform. And also for you guys out there, you don't want to get on a major playlist until you're ready, because if it doesn't perform, they'll yank it off that playlist, as, you know, so quickly.
You can't really get excited when you're at position number 89 on Rap Caviar with a playlist of 100. Because the average listener doesn't get past song 10 if you're just listening. It's like after song 10, it's like, you know what? I got to go fucking listen to some R&B now. You know what I mean? It's like, I've had enough of this trap shit. So getting on the playlist is one thing. The position on the playlist is a whole nother story. You want to be in the top 10, top 15, top 20, because when you're number 99, do people even get there? Maybe, maybe not. So stop begging for these playlists and start doing more marketing to warrant the record to be on the playlist.
All right, so talk about the marketing that people should be doing.
It's a little bit of everything. It's videos. It's a lot of content. Has to be press involved. You might not want to do it, but sometimes a little bit of mix show, even if it's regional. It's a little bit of everything. And even out of the box marketing, like if an artist is into cooking, tap into the cooking market and have your music playing in the background, because there is somebody who don't know who you are, but they love jerk chicken and they like the way you look. So they want to follow you to see how you cook jerk chicken. But and then when you got your music playing in the background, they're going, hey, what is that song in the background? Oh, yeah, that's my new single out now. You know what I mean? Like, these are little things that you could be doing as an artist, which doesn't even tap into your music thing that still promotes the music. Like, you have to do, it has to be lifestyle driven. Nowadays, marketing is lifestyle. If it's not believable, people ain't buying in. Perception is the new reality. People perceive shit to be bigger than it is, but now they have the internet and they can look and check up on you. They be like, wait, he said he bust his gun on track number 3, but he ain't got no fucking criminal record. Either he's lying or he's just a good ass criminal, and no criminals are that good. They all eventually get caught.
So you started out as a rapper, right? So yeah. Kind of tell us about your story. You've had a great career and you've been involved with so many amazing projects. So first talk about you, like how you got started, where you grew up, man. How you got started rapping, who were your influences, and then how did you get into the business side to kind of transition? There you are working for Sony and had an amazing career.
It's been a long journey, and I was saving the story for my book, so I'll give you bits and pieces of it. But, yeah, I was born and raised in Coney Island, Brooklyn. Actually, the Marbury family, famous basketball player Stephon Marbury, actually lived in the apartment above us. Actually, they lived 2 flights up. My family lived on the 2nd floor. They lived on the 4th floor. So big up to the Marbury family. Still talk to them to this day.
Wow, and, didn't know that.
Yeah. I was just a rapper dude like everybody else, you know, sending in my demos to record companies and shit like that. And I was working at a wallpaper firm doing financial services. I was an accountant and an assistant to the credit manager, but I was always into the rap thing. And I was always in the park on the mic. And, you know, I was the battle dude. And I always said, I'm going to fucking get a record deal. I was always in the club as well, Latin Quarter, Union Square. Like, I was always there. Wherever the hip-hop was, I was there. Me, all my peoples from the block, we were always there. And one day, I was just like, yo, I'm going to get on that fucking stage. I'm going to get on that Union Square stage. So at work one day, just randomly called the venue and asked, how do I perform on the hip-hop night at Union Square? And the guy was like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, what do you do? I was like, I'm a rapping comedian. Because I was like kind of telling jokes, but I rapped at the same time. So he was just hitting me with questions. I was just answering them on the fly. He was like, come in. On my lunch break the next day, I go into Union Square to meet with the manager. I think his name was Byron or Myron at the time. When I walk into this place to meet the guy, he's on the phone with guess who? DJ Red Alert. So the guy's like, hey, Red, I got this guy in here. He says he wants to rock the Union Square stage. What do you think? Red Alert was like, if he think he can do it, give him a shot. It's a tough crowd. Let him do it. The guy was like, all right, so we'll give you a guest list of 20. Be here on Friday night. Have a routine ready. That night, KRS-One is performing. And they're shooting the Bridges Over video that night in the video, because it was a performance video.
Wow.
My brother's in the video and the whole shit. It's crazy. So at the time, I was in high school then, and Clark Kent, the world-famous DJ Clark Kent, he was like another DJ that night at the spot at Union Square. But me and Clark Kent went to high school together. It's crazy. Me, Clark Kent, a couple of guys from Whistle. Remember that group Whistle?
Sure.
Select, UTFO, Kango Kids, still one of my good friends. I want to say MC Light, a couple of the guys from Full Force, all went to the same high school. So I go to perform at this place, and I tell Clark, I'm like, yo, this is my routine. I need somebody to just throw the record on for me or whatever. He's like, all right, cool, I got you. So Clark's like keying it up, and I'm fucking getting ready. And the first thing I dropped was this fucking routine I wrote called My Big Penis. It was like a parody of my Adidas. Years later, Weird Al convention took the fucking concept and ran with it and fucking watered it down and made it all poppy and crappy, but big up to him. But yeah, blew the fucking roof off the joint. So now I'm going through my routine. I'm kind of telling jokes and I'm rapping in between. And like, I had a whole routine that I had wrote in my head for like ever. And I said, as soon as I hit the stage, I'm going to do this fucking routine. And that was the routine I did that night. It was like 15 minutes. So somebody had said something about the bridge is over or something like that. Like in between the set, I was talking and I said something about the bridge or maybe about them shooting a video. And somebody said something about the bridge. And I said, yeah, the bridge is over. And everybody started laughing in the crowd. I was like, oh, I might have something here. And that's how my record Brooklyn Blew Up the Bridge came about. Because KRS had the bridges over and he was trying to help me get a record deal. And I won't go through that whole KRS-One story because that's for the book. But yeah, he was trying to help me get a deal and it didn't happen. And for reasons that will be told later. And that's kind of how I made my own record. I had went to a record company that KRS-One had sent me to at the time. He was like, yo, go see this guy. And I went to see the guy. And he gave me a fucking contract like this fucking thick. And I was like, what the fuck is this? And but when I was there, I seen Billboard magazine. And I was like, ooh, that's an interesting magazine. When I leave here, I'm going to go buy that magazine. When I left there, I fucking went to every newsstand in the city. Couldn't find it. Finally, I find the magazine. And I'm fascinated by it. This is the first time I ever seen Billboard. It was like charts and fucking music stories and all type of shit. I was just fucking amazed by this shit. And in the back, you might remember this, Neil and Warren. There was this little tiny ad that said, press your own records. 1,000 records for $1,000. And the name of that company.
Discmaster?
Discmakers.
Discmakers.
Discmakers. And I was like,
Discmakers.
I said, I got $1,000 in the bank. Maybe I should just do this shit since nobody wants to give me a fucking record deal. Like, I was Master P before Master P was Master P. You know what I mean? So I came up with the Brooklyn Blew Up the Bridge record based on someone laughing. Talking to Red Alert, you know, over the months, he was like, yeah, if you make a record, I'll play it for you. And at that time, I was like fucking damn near hosting fucking Union Square. I was like there every week on the stage doing something. And when Red said, oh, if you make a record, I'll play it. That's how I came up with Cool DJ Red Alert is a Great Man, which was on the same 12-inch. So it kind of happened really fast, but it took a while at the same time because this shit was a vision of mine and then it came to fruition.
And then how did you get your first job in the record business?
Another interesting story. So from that Discmakers ad, we went to record the music. Got the reel, got it mastered or whatever the fuck we did at the time, sent it off to Discmakers. And I think it was like 2 weeks later, because they pride themselves, 2 weeks delivery. 2 weeks later, fucking 10 or 20, 50 count boxes of my records show up at my house. And my mom's is like, what the fuck is this? What are all these boxes doing in my living room right now? And I'm like, Mom, don't worry about it. I'm going to get rid of it. It's my new record. And like, she didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Was, new record? You're not a fucking singer. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, no. And I swear I didn't know what the fuck I was going to do with these records. I did not know what I was going to do with these records. I just knew I had to find a way to get them to the store. But I knew they were on the floor in the living room. I was halfway there, Neil. So I went to a record store in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue that was in my neighborhood called INL Records. And I just went in and I was like, yo, where do you guys buy your music from? And they're like, oh, it's a couple of spots. It's a Pearl Music over here and it's fucking MCM over here and this other company over here.
S&J.
It was like one in the Bronx, one in Brooklyn. They were all over the place. Like it was record distributors all over the place. And all the record stores would buy records from these places and then resell them. So I was like, give me the number to the one in Brooklyn. And the guy gave me the number and I called him. I'm like, yeah, I'm looking for distribution. And the guy was like, ah, yeah, come in. So I go in with a box of records and I'm sitting there waiting to talk to the guy. And he's on the phone going, yeah, so we need somebody to work in the warehouse. Yeah, I don't care. My guy just quit. I need that. All they got to do is pick records. And I'm sitting there with a box of records in my hand, and I'm a fucking accountant right now doing accounts receivables at a wallpaper firm. And I'm like, I might want to work here. So I asked the guy, I was like, yeah, I kind of overheard you guys are looking for somebody to work in the warehouse. He was like, yeah, do you know anybody? I was like, yeah, I might want that job. He's like, well, it pays this and it pays that and you got to be here this day and that day. And I'm like, oh, shit, it was way less than what I was making fucking doing numbers and shit. But I knew I wanted in. So I took a pay cut and that's how I got at Pearl. And that's how I got my record in there. The day I got the job was the day I got my record distributed by Pearl. And it was a box of 50, and apparently a couple of stores had been looking for it because Red Alert was spinning the record from the acetates. Remember, they used to give you the acetate, the test press, and then listen to it first. Then you call them up and you say, yeah, this is good. Go with the pressing. I gave Red Alert the fucking acetates. And before I got fucking home, everybody was like, yo, your song was on the radio. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I just handed the record to him, got on the train, got to Brooklyn. He had already played the record.
Wow.
And he was playing it every fucking weekend for like months. It was crazy. He played it every weekend. He played two songs off my four-song EP every weekend for months. And Music Factory started calling Pearl for the record and Rock and Soul, like all these old school. It's crazy because me and a couple of friends, we were talking about, remember, we used to go to the record store and we used to wait for the Big Daddy Kane album. And when we heard the Public Enemy record, it was like, fuck, we got to get that shit. And we had to physically go to the store and get it. And they would sell out and we'd be fucking mad. It is like, yeah, the game is different, man.
You want to tell us quickly about how you wound up at Red?
Red? Well, that started at Pearl as well. When I was at Pearl, all the reps from all the different labels used to come in with the promos and because they used to try to get us to buy the records. Like, the PolyGram rep would come in, the Weir rep would come in. And this is how my fucking record collection is the size that it is now, because they all came in with promo shit and free shit because they were all just fucking enticing you to buy what they thought was the next big shit. You know what I mean? Great friend of mine, still a mentor of mine to this day. His name is Leighton Singleton. Leighton was the PolyGram rep at the time when I was at Pearl. And he seen the work I was doing. He seen my work ethic. And he was like, man, as soon as a job opens up at PolyGram, I'm going to pull you in. And lo and behold, he pulled me in. And that's where my major label job in the music industry started. Got right into PGD. And I stayed at PGD until Universal actually bought it. And then they started laying all these folks off. And I was one that got laid off. And I was fine. I was getting unemployment. I was getting a fucking severance check. I was making more fucking money than I was, having a regular job. And then my friend Mike Canner, who I was talking to yesterday, who told me about how good your podcast is, he called me up and said, yo, there's an urban position at Red. Mind you, I'm sitting on my ass. right now. I'm not even entertaining a job. I'm giving myself 90 days before I start looking again. By the time the 60-day mark hit, I was interviewing at Red because my guy knew the Urban guy at Red who just left, and he told Frank Falco, I got the guy for you, and it was me. I interviewed for that job, got into Red, and, you know, Red's owned by Sony, and I'm still in the Sony system to this day.
20 years
later. What year was that? So what year was that?
Oh, I don't even remember. 90,
yeah, like 20 years ago.
Well, right? It was definitely 20 years ago. And damn, I still look good.
kind of tell us about what you're working on now and, you know, kind of, you know, what we have to look forward to.
The last few years of my music industry career has been great. I mean, I've helped work and develop projects from Run the Jewels, Joey Badass, G Herbo. These are all cats that, you know, started from the bottom. Now they're here type thing, you know, and I got plaques on my wall to prove my worth. You know, a lot of people get plaques just based on being involved or just by default. No, I was fucking in the trenches with these guys. You know what I mean? So, yeah, man, a lot of great artists I've worked with over the years. And currently I'm kind of on my R&B gospel swing. So right now I got a new project from Mario coming out this month, October 16th-ish, I think. I'm working with Maya now, and she's been great. Like, she's like a one-woman machine. Big up to her. I'm talking to Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis about this new Stokely record featuring Snoop Dogg. Gospel side, I'm working with Tamela Mann and Ja'Kalen Carr. So I'm a little all over the place, but I love it, though. You know, working with these guys and helping develop.
Well, And amazing. I really appreciate you being part of our podcast.
Shit,
and
I was the label manager for Penalty Records too, baby.
Yes, he was.
Let's
yes,
not forget.
He was. For years.
And I still need you to get me on Drink Champs. I need to talk to Nori. Call him for me.
Hear
please.
That, Nori?
Call him.
Hear
call
that?
Him.
Okay.
Thank
okay.
you, guys.
Well, really appreciate. Thank you.
It's been fun, man. Appreciate you guys. By all means.
Bye. Thanks,
hey,
guys.
Thank you for okay. this.
All right. You got it.
See, okay. see you bye. Soon.
Peace and love.
Bye.